Hello, everybody.
And hello, everyone.
My name is Tom.
My name is Ben.
And together we are
The Thinking Drinkers.
And welcome to our Thinking Drinkers podcast, which is all about drink, isn't it, Ben?
It is. It's all about our motto,
our mantra,
our message, which is drink less,
but drink better.
Yes, if you like drink, then this is a podcast for you. Before we start talking about drink, I think we should tell our lovely listeners a little bit about us, because I don't mind telling you, Tom, we're a bit of a big deal.
Aren't we just? When it comes to the drinks world, we are pretty much top dogs. We're the big cheeses of the world of drink.
We're heavyweights.
We are.
We're overweights.
Well, you certainly are. So Ben is Ben McFarland. Not only is he a beer writer, he's the three-time winner of
not
beer
once,
writer.
Not twice, three times.
Okay. Three-time beer writer of the year.
Yep.
The youngest ever recipient of such an award.
Yes.
Ben's life started off in regional press, working in Brighton on a local newspaper, the Argus down there, but he quickly became embroiled in the world of drink, working on the Publican newspaper, which is where I met you all those years ago, and then ventured off into freelance beer writing, which is where he started to pick up these prestigious beer writing awards. So that's Ben. He's probably the peasant of the duo, if I say, scratching around in the pork scratchings.
The world of beer.
Floor.
Yes. Less glamorous than your life, Tom.
Oh, isn't
it? Let
me
tell the audience about you. Again, started in local newspapers in Hertfordshire. What did you work on? What's it called?
Oh, the Hearts Herald.
The Hearts Herald. There
big
we go.
Up. Big up.
Then you went to the Publican. You were the chief reporter, weren't you?
News reporter. Yep.
That's where we met. Then we did the Good Beer Guide West Coast USA, travelling up and down the West Coast of America, writing about the brew pubs, the microbrewery scene, the craft beer scene there. We came back. We knew that it was going to kick off here. The best thing we should have done was open a brewery. Did we open a brewery, Tom?
Did we?
But you went on to cocktails and spirits. You know everything about spirits, loads of stuff about cocktails. And you were the Educator of the Year, as named by the IWSC, which is the... What is that?
Well, it's the International Wine and Spirits Challenge. If you buy a bottle of wine in the shop and it's got one of those fancy badges on it, they're the same organisation that look after spirits.
Beyond that, nothing special. So that's our backgrounds. But our big claim to fame...
claim to anonymity.
Is since 2011, we have been performing a comedy tasting show up and down the country where people get five free drinks, and it's about the history of alcohol. Essentially, it's a show that is designed to make people drink less but drink better.
We thought, why not turn this into a piece of comedy theatre and tell these stories through the medium of theatre and dressing up? And we're currently on tour with our Heroes of Hooch incarnation of this, and next year we'll be going back to the Edinburgh Fringe with our new show called Pub Quiz, in which we will get 200 people at a time trying to do a pub quiz. It's going to be difficult.
No idea how we're going to do it, but it'll be our 10th year back at the Fringe.
And what we want to do with our podcast is enlighten you to improve your drinking lives, to broaden your drinking horizons. So the point of the Thinking Drinkers podcast is to educate you a bit, entertain you a bit, tell some of the stories behind the great drinks that we enjoy, and essentially make your lives better through the medium of
pub ammo to tell their mates and to spread the good word of discerning boozing.
With that in mind, I think it's probably time for us to start the podcast with a drink.
You may have noticed, Tom, it's been a few weeks since Brexit. And regardless of whether you think it's a good idea or not, I think we could do with a beer. Especially one that, like Brexit, polarises opinion. And what better way to commemorate 47 years in the European Union than with a slightly sour beer that's been brewed in and around an otherwise unremarkable corner of Belgium for more than 500 years.
Belgium.
So we're starting this with the lambic beer. Now, this is proper geeky. This is like catnip to craft beer geeks. What distinguishes lambic and gurs, which is blended lambic beers, from other conventional beers like lager, is the fact that it's spontaneously fermented with naturally occurring local airborne yeast.
Whoa!
There's yeast everywhere in the air. There's air yeast over there.
I think I've got some on the inside of my leg.
I think you do, Tom. People didn't know that yeast was fermenting because it was invisible. Before early man had a microscope, they called yeast in the air, they called it God is good, because they thought it was the magical manna from heaven, and yeast would settle on grain and water, ferment it and turn it from sludgy porridge into essentially what was beer.
At the bottle, Ben. Let's get this open, because it's got a cork in it.
It's got a cork in it.
Which might make a sound.
Wait, shh.
Oh, nicely done. And pour it. Let's see the. Okay, there's a lovely bit of smoke coming off. Wow,
that,
it's quite a lively looking beer. I don't know why I thought it might look a bit flat.
So what they do, they put the beer in the unfermented beer in essentially a cool ship, like a swimming pool. The yeast comes down from the air and ferments it naturally. This is almost too bloody artisan. When we talk about artisan beer, this is proper artisan. It's called Cantillon Creek, and it's a cherry beer. Cantillon's in this really rough part of Brussels. It's more like a museum than a microbrewery. It's like a tumble-down time warp. There's big frothing oak barrels everywhere. It looks like it's falling apart. There's fusty fumes everywhere. There's pipes drip, hoses trip, and it's like there's all these wooden tuns and copper vessels. Basically, it could really do with a clean.
Well, why don't they clean it, Ben?
Because if they cleaned it, then all the natural bugs and bacteria and yeast in the air would be destroyed and they wouldn't be able to create this amazing historic beer.
I do remember thinking, my God, this place could do with a clean. What's interesting, I've tasted that straight off the bat. When I think of flavoured things in the world of spirits, I often think of saccharin and aroma chemicals and things that don't naturally occur, but that tastes like sour cherries.
That's amazing. They're really, really good beers, and the thing about them is that when you first taste a lambic, it doesn't taste like beer should taste. It draws in your cheeks like your Kenneth Williams or something like that. But it's more like a cider or a sherry than a beer, but then you kind of get used to it. You start to crave those flavours as well. So it's like a good album. It takes a while to get into it, but after a while you do. And the addition of the fruit actually makes it a little bit easier to drink.
And I'd imagine that, and we talk a lot in our tasting experiences with audiences about putting certain drinks on the table with your food. That's a good way to get into drink. Now, that is a perfect example of how beer can be on the dinner table, Ben. You'd have that with something to eat, but what would you probably have it?
I'd go
some sort of some duck. Artisan.
Duck's quite nice with cherries.
I was going to say chocolate.
Chocolate. I don't know.
Twix.
Yeah, minstrels. The important thing here is glassware. See, we're obsessed with a pint. A lot of people say, I like that beer, but couldn't drink a pint of it. You don't need to drink a pint of it. Drink it out of a champagne flute or a wine glass. Not in a pub, because you get your head kicked in.
Yeah, I've got to pull you up on that. Yeah. As someone who drinks cocktails, I'm going to pull you up on drinking beer out of a champagne flute.
No, but it does taste better and it looks good.
Yeah, that's
and
good.
You drink with your eyes, Tom. In a champagne flute, it looks très bon, as they say, in parts of Belgium. No, it's a great beer, but it does polarise opinion. Connoisseurs regard it as the most quixotic and cultured expression of the brewing art, while others simply can't see the attraction of a sour, tart beer that tastes a bit like a goat smells. It divides opinion, a lot like Brexit. Now, we are very proud to have Samantha Capehorn, a.k.a. the Mistress of Wine, here in the studio. She is our go-to wine guru. Over the series of these podcasts, she's going to be bringing in lots of different wines for us to taste and savour. And I must just add at this point that Tom and I know nothing about wine.
Not yet.
We don't. And we're entirely reliant on you, Sam.
One of the very few masters of wine.
389. In the world. So more people have been in space than hold the Master of Wine quality.
That is amazing.
Mm. I bust that fact out quite a bit.
Do you know which astronaut took wine to the moon?
The second man to walk on the moon, Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah.
He took it up there. They did a wine drinking ceremony before they stepped out of the spacecraft onto the surface of the moon.
He took some red wine, communion wine, but still it's wine.
It counts. He drank booze on the moon. But you're here today to gently ease us into our wine drinking knowledge. So you are going to distill everything down that you know about wine into a very small fraction of information. So how are you going to do this?
I've learned lots of different things, obviously studying for the wine exams, blah blah blah, but the thing I think a lot of consumers don't know and don't understand, which is the absolutely holy grail when it comes to wine, is that different wines are made of different grape varieties and different grape varieties taste of different things. But some wines aren't labeled by grape variety, they are labeled by region. So to distill that down, you have generally New World Wines. Ben, you're looking so confused. Stay with me.
Red wine.
You got red
and white wine.
Yeah, and the pink one, the one in the middle. That's
green. Not a blend, though.
Mix them together.
It can be in champagne. Actually, you do just
really.
Yeah, you do just whack some red wine into it to make it pink. Anyway, so you've got the New World over there. You've got the Old World, Europe nearer to us, and basically in the New World, you label by grape variety. So you'd go into a shop or a restaurant, and it says on it Sauvignon or Chardonnay or Merlot or Pinot Noir or Shiraz, and you hopefully might recognize those and know that they're different grape varieties, and those different grape varieties taste of different things. So right. Sauvignon is quite kind of crunchy and green, and Shiraz is quite peppery and full-bodied. But to make it really difficult, in Europe the wines are generally labelled according to region. So Chablis is a place. You can go on holiday in Chablis. Yeah. Sans, it'd be a bit cold. And as long as you like wine, that's fine. Mm-hmm. And it's a place. And you can only grow Chardonnay. Sancerre is a place. White Sancerre is
Burgundy's
Sauvignon.
A place.
Burgundy's a place.
Oh,
Champagne
no, I knew this about
place.
Sancerre because I went in and I said, like a Sancerre. Thinking, well, that's basically a Sauvignon Blanc because
correct.
I'd choose a Sauvignon Blanc. But yeah. If I say Sancerre,
yeah.
It sounds like I'm not just choosing like the cheap Sauvignon Blanc.
Well, then you're not, because Sancerre is quite expensive.
Oh, good.
It's a very small, okay. It's a small village, and therefore, it's because it's a small village, you know, supply.
All right, okay. So yeah, I'm going to say some regions, and you have to fire back
for
great variety.
Oh, God. Okay.
Burgundy. Let's start with that.
White is Chardonnay, red is Pinot Noir.
Bordeaux.
You've got Left Bank and you've got White Bank. Right Bank is Merlot dominated generally.
Okay.
Left Bank is Cabernet Sauvignon dominated. And then you get Sauvignon Semillon blends for the whites and the sweet wines.
If I come to you and I say, I don't know anything about wine, what should I do? What's the first thing I should read about? I would go into a supermarket, despite the fact that I write about discerning spirits, and I'd look at price.
Yeah.
So
I would say, be wary of price. I have vivid memories of buying a lovely lilac jumper covered with bubbles on it in the January sale because it was cheap.
Okay.
And did I like it? Because it was cheap and it was money off and all this kind of stuff. Did I wear it? No. Is it now an Oxfam? Yes. Has no one else bought it? Probably not.
As if they haven't suffered enough.
Exactly. So what I would say is generally don't go with price. Try and look at the wines that you already drink, what the grape variety is. Therefore, look at what the flavour might be and see what you like.
Okay, so thank you, Sam, for coming in. I think to summarise, what we have learned today from you, thank you so much, is that the Old World label their wines by region, and Tom, the New World label their wines by
grape.
But yes.
What we've also learned from you, Sam, is that wine is indeed very complicated and we do need a master of wine to help simplify it for our simple minds. So we'll look forward to hearing more from you with some actual wine that we can drink to ease us through that process and learn more about it as we follow our motto,
our message,
our mantra.
Drink less,
but drink better.
Thank you very much.
So, now we're on to a section of our podcast that we like to call Spit or Swallow, something in the world of drink that has irritated us or pleased us. And I'm going to start this week with my spit, which is the bad thing. And I'm going to talk about pink gin, Ben. Gin is going great guns. They reckon that Britain's drank an estimated 61.7 million litres of gin last year.
Wowzers.
But a lot of what's pushing this growth in gin is flavoured gin, and specifically pink gin. So what is pink gin? Well, pink gin is a gin that is infused with any sort of pink fruit. So grapefruits, rhubarb, strawberries, rose, raspberries. The problem I have with pink gin is that it doesn't taste like gin. For those of you who think you're into the gin revolution, you should be tasting a spirit that predominantly smells or tastes of juniper. Juniper is the essential botanical in our gin. It's the piney, slightly bitter quality that we get in gin. Pink gins are dialing that juniper back almost so it's non-existent. So the people who think they like gin but are drinking pink gins are not really necessarily gin fans. There are a lot of people who are jumping on this bandwagon, Ben, and it's definitely getting out of control. We think there are about 1,400 different gym brands out there at the moment, but it's safe to say that a lot of these are starting to resemble nothing more than flavoured vodka. And frankly, I think it's time to call bullshit on this entire operation. If we go back to what it actually means, the history of pink gin, these pink gins are nothing, they don't resemble anything like the pink gins that we had from the outset. If we go back to the 1820s and Henry Worksop, who was an English ship surgeon on the HMS Hercules, he invented pink gin. He was travelling around the Caribbean, his crew were getting sick, and they were having to chew on quinine or quinchona bark to help fight off malaria. It tasted disgusting. He discovered Angostura bitters. This was a drink that infused the qualities and properties of quinchona bark and other medicinal properties into a drink, and he added that to the gin ration that was aboard their ship. So he added these drops of Angostura bitters to his warm gin. It turned the drink pink, and that was a pink gin. They were drinking warm room temperature and probably quite hot gin with these bitters in. It was nothing like these oversized copper goblet serves with their ice and their blossoms flailing from the side of it. It was a hearty drink that was meant to make you better. I have had enough of pink gins. What say you?
Well, I say that I agree, Tom. I think it's disgusting. And I think unless you're suffering from scurvy or some other naval disease and you're drinking pink gin, there is no excuse.
No. Gin is juniper. If you think you're a gin fan, drink gins which has got juniper in.
Proper gin.
Now it's probably time to cheer the listener up. What have you got for us that we can swallow this week?
This is a very good swallow. I'm very, very happy to report that after 15 years of closures, Tom, the number of pubs in the UK has risen for the first time. But there is no time for complacency. People have been very pleased that all these pubs have started reopening. There's only 350 new ones, and most of them are small ones. But still, it's the grassroots of optimism there. But there's no time for complacency because pubs are still under threat from VAT, which is massive, business rates, they're crippling pubs. Then you've got beer tax, much higher here than anywhere else in Europe, apart from the Scandi countries. People are staying at home more, looking at Netflix and Amazon Prime. People are stuck on social media, swiping left, instead of going down a pub and meeting people. They're talking to each other. They feel like they're more connected, but they've never been more alone. And the pub has and still is an antidote to loneliness. We need to go to the pub, have a couple of pints, loosens that stiff upper lip that is synonymous with the British culture and get talking. And pubs are local businesses. They need saving. If we don't use them, we are going to lose them. But pubs, historically, are the cornerstone of our culture. We owe our language to it. The very essence of life was discovered in a pub by Francis Crick when he discovered DNA. And statistics show that 1 in 4 of us fell in love in a pub. So go out, have a pint, go to the pub, use it, fall in love, even if it is for just one night.
You know what? My neighbour is in his 80s. He has no other social outlet. So I say that pub is saving his life. Pubs are saving lives. Ben, I am ready to swallow the increase of pubs. That's been a beautiful swallow, and we look forward to more impassioned spitting or swallowing next week.
Right, Tom, I see in your right hand there you have a bottle of something that looks rather impressive. Tell me about it.
Well, Ben, I have got something impressive in my hand. It's rum. This is Santa Teresa 1796 rum. I've just come back from Venezuela.
No way.
Yes, I was on a fantastic trip to a rum distillery out there. A lot of people think rum comes from the Caribbean. Actually, by law, rum can be made anywhere in the world, and I've come back from this distillery in Venezuela, and they make this beautiful aged rum out there, but it's a fantastic distillery generally. The guys who run it are doing a hell of a lot for their local community. When Chavez was in power, he sent a lot of his minions up to the distillery and tried to take it off the owners because he believed it was an example, a shining beacon of capitalism. So he urged the people to take the distillery.
Wanted to nationalise it.
Yeah, but these people ended up on the doorstep and they didn't know what they were going to do with it. They were just going to take it off the owners and corrupt the land. So the owners said to them, well, rather than just taking this land and not doing anything with it, why don't you work for us? We'll give you jobs. So they created jobs for all the people who were unemployed and didn't have any money. They built houses. They turned the whole thing into a tourist project. And then they went a step further and started going out into the local community, specifically the favelas in Caracas. And I don't know if you know much about crackers, Ben, but having recently been there, I can attest it's pretty terrifying. Dangerous. Yeah, it's a bit tasty.
Well, I grew up in Chiswick, West London, so I know what it's like on the street.
Similar, but more dangerous. We weren't allowed to go anywhere. We got picked up from the airport in these armour-proof 4x4s, and they took us for dinner in Caracas, but you're not allowed to go anywhere on your own. It's incredibly dangerous. And the guys who run the Santa Teresa distillery, the Vollmer brothers, they're fifth-generation Europeans, so they're quite white guys. They wear button-down Oxford shirts and chinos, and they went into the favelas with their laptops and tried to convince these criminals to come out and
That's
work.
Ballsy.
It was ballsy. And I met some of these guys who'd come out of the favelas who were former assassins and who were close to killing these brothers, thinking they were police officers. So they really put their...
Can I just say, I've seen even plainclothes police officers wouldn't wear chinos and button-down shirts.
Well, exactly.
Very plain
clothes. You'd have to say, that's a pretty bad disguise, officer.
Yeah. The old double bluff.
Yeah. I was talking to this guy out there. I had a translator. And after about 10 minutes, the guy said, yeah, and this kid, when he was 14, was the most feared assassin in the whole of Caracas. I mean, these are the sorts of people they've taken out and rehabilitated and given them work on the distillery. So it's an incredible setup, and they really have worked very hard with the community to try and improve the quality of life. And at the same time, they're distilling extraordinary rum. Where they're based in Venezuela is a bit like a micro environment that's perfect for sugarcane. And at the heart of rum is sugar, molasses, sugarcane juice, sugarcane honey. And the sugarcane that grows here is perfect. They grow their own, they pick their own, they make their own sugar, they then ferment that, and they turn it into a distillate, which is rum. So we've got the Santa Teresa 1796. 1796 was the year they started distilling, and they used the Solero aging method. For any sherry fans listening, that's the sherry method of maturation, where they stack four barrels on top of each other.
And then the oldest one drips down. And
the oldest one's at the bottom. Solero means ground, and the top one is the youngest. So they fill the first barrel, and then they let that rest there for a while, and they drop it into the next barrel, and they top up. Every time they take the oldest rum from the bottom, they top up with the youngest rum at the top, and it slowly matures as it trickles down.
Okay, so you have the maturity of age with the exuberance of youth.
You do. And, I mean, it's very difficult in the rum world. Perhaps one criticism of this method is very difficult to give a specific age statement on this. But the oldest rum in your 1796 will be 35 years old.
All right, let's taste it.
Let's have a taste. Give it a smell first. They've used European oak in there. So when you're smelling a spirit, if it's used European oak, that's a slightly grape, winey, sort of grapier, currant notes. And they've also matured it, they finished it at the end in American oak, so you get a little hint of vanilla, the vanillins on the
that way. Is amazing. Do you know what I'm getting there? I'm getting I want to sound like a right pompous idiot by saying this, creme brulee, which is French for pudding.
yogurt
burn yogurt.
I'm getting petit falou. I mean, creme brulee is about right.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't think you can drink rum neat. These are the sorts of rums. I mean, this will set you back about £50. You can get it on the whiskeyexchange.com.
So it can be, because a lot of people, when they drink rum, they do it with a cheap mixer, but this is a sipping rum.
It is. And there are a lot of great sipping rums out there. Venezuela is just one country that's producing these luxury rums. But there's loads going on in there. You've got the smoky notes, dark chocolate. A really fantastic rum from a fantastic distillery. Cheers. Next up, we've got our legend of liquor. This is a story about someone from the world of drink, dead or alive, who's contributed in some amazing way to our lives. So, Ben, who have you got for us this week?
Well, Tom, this week I've got a woman. But she's more than just a woman. She's a nun. She's a 12th century German nun that goes by the name of Hildegard of Bingen. And she was a multitasker. She was the ultimate medieval multitasker, in fact, who fought the feminist fight on a number of different fronts at a time when women really didn't do that kind of thing. Now, while other nuns used to potter about a convent and pray and stuff, Bingen became a seriously big deal in 12th century Europe and had several strings to her bow. Popes, kings and bishops sought her counsel, and she was also the advisor and physician to the German emperor. She was a prophet, she was a poet, She was a marvellous medieval musician and composer. She penned highly influential theological treatises.
Wow, that's just not easy to say after a few years.
No, on everything. She wrote about rocks. She wrote about religion. She wrote about trees and potions. And unusually for a nun, she was the first ever person to write about the fictional female orgasm.
That's right, ladies.
Absolutely true.
She said fictional. So what the hell has she got to do with beer, Ben?
Let me just read the thing she said about the female orgasm.
Okay.
A sense of heat in her brain, which brings with it sensual delight, communicates the taste of that delight during the act and summons forth the emission of the man's seed. What a dirty devil. But she is also, Tom, you asked about how this relates to beer. She was also the first person to write about hops in brewing.
Right.
In Physica, the second vast volume of her...
Let's get Physica. Physica.
She used to write loads of stuff. She wrote this massive book called Physica, which everyone's read at the time.
Physica Education.
Yeah, and she dedicated chapter 61 concerning the hop to its preservative powers. So she was the first person to work out if you put hops in beer, it keeps it for longer. And she also said this. She said, this type of beer purges the stomach of the drinker and renders his heart light and joyous. And she was also a home brewer. And she had a daily ration of heartily hot beer until she died aged 81 in 1179. And 81, back in the 12th century, that's a seriously good innings.
That's like 181 now,
isn't
it?
Yeah, it's like dog years.
No, so this is quite interesting,
212
though,
or something like that.
I remember reading once that the Scots put hemlock nightshade and cow dung into their beers, which is why it tasted like shit, listeners. But this was the first person who said hops. Now, hops, we all associate hops with.
So I don't want to go into too much history because it's dead dull. But up until about the 16th century, beer, or it was called ale, didn't have hops in it.
You're right.
But anyway, they should put seaweed in there, bog myrtle, stuff like that. And then the Dutch brought over some hops. Green stuff from Holland. Though we were rightly very suspicious of that.
Yeah.
And that's when we started putting hops in there. And our hops are like great.
She was the first,
300 years before that, she was like, hops are the way forward. She was a bit of a visionary. And she was also a massive, massive enemy of drinking water. She drank beer every day, so she said this. Whether one is healthy or infirm, if one is thirsty after sleeping, one should drink wine or beer, but not water. For water might damage rather than help one's blood. Beer fattens the flesh and lends a beautiful colour to the face. Water, however, weakens a person.
God.
Amen to that. So there you go, Tom. Hildegard of Bingen, our 12th century crazy German nun, who's the first person to write about hops in beer and was also the first person to write about the fictional female orgasm. And she is the first of what we hope to be a long list of legends of liquor.
So that's our podcast. We've been the Thinking Drinkers and we've really enjoyed making that, haven't we, Ben?
We certainly have, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you want to hear more from us...
And we'd really hope to do more of these podcasts because we like them, then please do email ian@muddyneesmedia.com to find out more. That's ian@muddyneesmedia.com.
If you do, there might be some booze in it, but remember to always follow our motto...
Our message.
Our mantra.
Drink less...
But drink better.
Muddy Knees Media.